Mr. Thompson, another profoundly amnesic patient I knew, dealt with his abysses of amnesia by fluent confabulations. I originally described Mr. Thompson in A Matter of Identity, a chapter in The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. He was wholly immersed in his quickfire inventions and had no insight into what was happening. So far as he was concerned, there was nothing the matter. He would confidently identify or misidentify me as a friend of his, a customer in his delicatessen, a kosher butcher, another doctor, as a dozen different people in the course of a few minutes. This sort of confabulation was not one of conscious fabrication. It was rather a strategy, a desperate attempt, unconscious and almost automatic, to provide a sort of continuity, a narrative continuity, when memory and thus experience was being snatched away every instant. Though one cannot have direct knowledge of one's own amnesia, there may be ways to infer it, from the expressions on people's faces when one has repeated something half a dozen times, when one looks down at one's coffee cup and finds that it is empty, when one looks at one's diary and sees entries in one's own handwriting. Lacking memory, lacking direct experiential knowledge, amnesiacs have to make hypotheses and inferences, and they usually make plausible ones. They can infer that they have been doing something, been somewhere, even though they cannot recollect what they have been doing or where. Yet Clive, rather than making plausible guesses, always came to the conclusion that he had just been awakened, that he had been dead. This seemed to me a reflection of the almost instantaneous effacement of perception for Clive. Thought itself was almost impossible within this tiny window of time. Indeed, Clive once said to Deborah, "I am completely incapable of thinking." At the beginning of his illness, Clive would sometimes be confounded at the bizarre things he experienced. Deborah wrote of how, coming in one day, she saw him holding something in the palm of one hand and repeatedly covering and uncovering it with the other hand, as if he were a magician practicing a disappearing trick. He was holding a chocolate. He could feel the chocolate unmoving in his left palm, and yet every time he lifted his hand, he told me it revealed a brand new chocolate. "Look," he said, "it's new." He couldn't take his eyes off it. "It's the same chocolate," I said gently. "No, look, it's changed. It wasn't like that before." He covered and uncovered the chocolate every couple of seconds, lifting and looking. "Look, it's different again. How do they do it?" Within months, Clive's confusion gave way to the agony, the desperation that are so clear in Miller's film. This, in turn, was succeeded by a deep depression, as it came upon him, if only in sudden, intense, and immediately forgotten moments, that his former life was over, that he was incorrigibly disabled, and that the rest of his life would be spent in institutions. As the months passed without any real improvement, the hope of significant recovery became fainter and fainter, and towards the end of 1985, Clive was moved to a room in a chronic psychiatric unit, a room he was to occupy for the next 6.5 years, but which he was never able to recognize as his own. A young psychologist saw Clive for a period of time in 1990 and kept a verbatim record of everything he said, and this caught the grim mood that had taken hold. Clive said at one point, "Can you imagine one night, 5 years long? No dreaming, no waking, no touch, no taste, no smell, no sight, no sound, no hearing, nothing at all. It's like being dead. I came to the conclusion that I was dead." The only times of feeling alive were when Deborah visited him. But the moment she left, he was desperate once again, and by the time she got home, 10 or 15 minutes later, she would find repeated messages from him on her answering machine. "Please come and see me, darling. It's been ages since I've seen you. Please fly here at the speed of light." To imagine the future was no more possible for Clive than to remember the past. Both were engulfed by the onslaught of amnesia. Yet, at some level, Clive could not be unaware of the sort of place he was in and the likelihood that the rest of his life, his endless night, would be spent in such a place. But then, 7 years after his illness, after huge efforts made by Deborah, Clive was moved to a small country residence for the brain-injured, much more congenial than a hospital. Here he was one of only a handful of patients and in constant contact with a dedicated staff who treated him as an individual and respected his intelligence and talents. He was taken off most of his heavy tranquilizers and seemed to enjoy his walks around the village and gardens near the home, the spaciousness, the fresh food. For the first 8 or 9 years in this new home, Deborah told me, Clive was calmer and sometimes jolly, a bit more content, but often with angry outbursts still, unpredictable, withdrawn, spending most of his time in his room alone. But gradually, in the last 6 or 7 years, Clive has become more sociable, more talkative. Conversation, though of a scripted sort, has come to fill what had been before empty, solitary, and desperate days.